I'm Bill Teeple, and I'm here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and our special guest, Mary Snyder Behrens. And this is Icon Art Radio. Okay, this is this another session that we're getting to have with Mary. And you can go ahead and ask the question you always like to ask of our guest artists, Donna.
I love to hear about beginnings. I've always been fascinated with beginnings of any sort, and I've found that all artists have an interesting story about their very first impulse to make art, where that came from, how old were you, and how did that manifest, and how did your journey progress from there?
I think that, I was always, my mother would tell you I was always busy as a kid. I mean, I was never bored. There was always something that I was doing, and that could have been, you know, mud pies out in the back, you know, and decorating with flower petals. I think that I liked taking things apart and reassembling them. I was always ripping magazines apart. I think one of the biggest influences of my life was puzzle making. When I was very, very small, my father would clear off the dining room table and he would start a puzzle, and I could be sitting opposite him with the puzzle upside down as a little kid, maybe 5 years old, 6 years old, and point to tell him where the pieces belonged. I mean, I always had that sort of understanding of abstract shapes. I mean, because it wasn't the visual I was looking at, it was just the pieces. And I think that I was always drawing as a kid, always drawing. I think I was sick a lot as a kid, and so I was always staying home and drawing. I don't think that I thought about it seriously as a career or anything, probably until after I got out of high school and I wondered what I was going to do. And that's when I decided I was going to go to school. But at first, I did not study art. I was I had a psychology major for my first few years in school, sort of to appease my parents. Mm-hmm. And then after a few years of that, I decided, no, this is not what I want to do. I want to be a painter. And then I went to the College of Art and Design in Minneapolis for a couple years, and then transferred to the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee, where I think my focus really was very, very anatomically tight figure drawing. Did a lot of figure work. When I got out of school, I got married and moved into an apartment and could not paint in oils anymore. And of course, I didn't have access to a figure like I had when I was a student. And I thought it a bit demeaning at first, but I went back to painting still lifes. And in the process, I learned something about myself, that I really had no interest in painting this stuff. I had more interest in just moving the stuff around. Hmm. And slowly but surely,
like
the paint...
the setting up of the still life, yeah, was as interesting as painting.
More interesting. It was almost like setting a stage. Yeah. And slowly but surely, I stopped painting and I started just using things and, you know, assembling them in collages. And from there, I started adding bits of fabric and then sewing into the collages. And pretty much the paper disappeared and it was all, you know, old shirts and fabrics, you know, and lots of stitching, you know, so much stitching, you could barely see the thread underneath that. And I did that for quite a while, and slowly but surely the painting kind of worked back in, and now I sort of do it all, you know, all these things come into my scheme. That's what Gertrude Stein said, and it was one of my favorite quotes. She said, everything must come into your scheme, and I've, that's one of my mantras. So.
Yeah, that's good. Well, and the whole little box thing, one of my favorite artists is Joseph Cornell, and when I first saw his boxes in some museum in Europe, I was absolutely mesmerized, and it was like going to a little tiny play, mm-hmm. standing there in front mm-hmm. of it. It was almost like I had to myself become an inch tall to be able to really enjoy this piece. But when I was looking at your works before we started recording the show, I had that same sense, mm-hmm. and I remembered, you know, oh, those Joseph Cornell boxes. These are like bigger versions, but they have that same magical quality of objects taking on a personality of their own and as if in motion, even though there's still pieces, but it's as if they're in motion somehow.
I like to have that sort of suspended belief going on that things could start moving off, you know, and moving around. Mm-hmm. And I think about pinball games and how fascinated I am by those kinds of automata kind of things, moving objects. And when I look at some of those Cornells, I mean, those were meant to be played with, you know, so that the sand would switch around and I think I'm much too uptight to let people play with my work, but I wish that I could, you know, I wish I could create, you know, games that had no more rules, you know, where it was just this box of stuff, you know, that was interesting to play with.
Wow, this sounds like an event.
That sounds like a wonderful project.
I think if you started out with that intention, you could probably do it.
You
decided this was going to be something people could mm-hmm. play with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, and it ties into the idea of putting the Altoids boxes in your pocket.
Mm-hmm.
That,
mm-hmm.
you know, interacting with the viewer doesn't destroy the art, it just changes it.
It does
and
change
if
it.
You're and open to it.
Maybe we should
okay.
plan on a show at Icon for handled bearings.
I had a terrible time. My last installation here it was a big white panel with tiny speakers on each side, and they were very small. And it never occurred to me in a million years that people would see them and think they were buttons. That it was supposed to be pushed.
Oh.
And they would hear the sound and they would think, oh, well, I'll push that and it'll change the sound or something. So they would push it, and of course, pushing on a little tiny speaker, you'd make fingernail dents in it, and it's very easy to completely destroy the speaker. And it took me a while to adapt to the reality that, you know, unless we put up big, you know, barriers or something, people were going to handle this thing even though they're supposed to know better.
Well, that comes from this culture of the interactive science thing, you know, where, you know, everybody kind of just runs wild and pushes every button and,
right.
you know, tries to make
right.
things happen.
Product of the exploratorium.
Yeah.
Well, I think I grew up in the era where do not touch.
So. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I grew up in the Metropolitan Museum of Art, and as a little boy, I learned early on that I was not going to be allowed to walk around there by myself unless I was, you know, radiating respect at a very high level. If you walk into a room and then you walk up to like 10 feet away from a painting and you stop cold as if there's a wall in front of you, and then you look back at the guard who's been glaring at you ever since you walked into the room, and he sort of recognizes that you recognize that you're not supposed to touch the paintings, and then you're okay for that room, and then the next room you got to train the next guard that, you know, you're okay, you're safe, you're not going to put a big ice cream handprint on a Picasso.
I saw an installation in London that was just a box on the floor, a low box on the floor with a pile of oranges in it, a giant, you know, great big pile of oranges. And the whole point of the work was people were supposed to go and take an orange. Mm-hmm. And the artist would come periodically and photograph the pile and the particular organic shape of it. And all of these photographs were on the wall above the box. And they were a beautiful series of all of the different ways that the shape of the pile of oranges changed as people took an orange. But most of the people, when I was there, did not take one. It was just because they were also programmed in that way.
You were supposed to figure it out yourself, that you were supposed to take
one? Well, there was
one.
Actually a sign there saying, please take an orange, you know, and that was obviously the point of the piece. But even with that permission, most of the people were shy to take the orange.
Yeah. People are shy, though. I mean, they really are.
Yeah.
Well, that brings up the permission thing. It was a question I had when you shifted from feeling that making a work of art was painting the still life to the point that you were enjoying so much doing the still life, arranging it, that you that became more your art. Did you have to give yourself permission to go there? Did you feel like you were going into a territory that was, or had you seen enough art like Joseph Cornell and stuff to know that you were just changing your medium kind of? Or was there some kind of like a breakthrough for you?
I think it was a liberating experience for me to move away from, you know, the standard, you know, flat two-dimensional painting to something that was, you know, collaged. And I know that when I was at MCAD, One of the things that was most important that I learned from a teacher, and that he said that when we make art, we make it by any means possible. Mm-hmm. And he said that urgency, whatever it is, you must seize upon. And I've never forgotten that. And prior to that, I don't think I could have done that. But the experience there was not about product. It was really about an experience and play. And so that became very, very important to me, to be able to allow myself to play seriously. And, you know, growing up in a very, very strict Catholic family, that was not something that, you know, was allowed. I mean, we didn't have that sort of freedom of expression. You know, we're a very rigid family. So moving into that other, you know, dimension was not difficult, but it's always very tight for me. I mean, I can't throw paint. You know, it's not something I can do. But you know, when I think about some of these shapes, you know, those things were present in the work way back when, and the targets are targets, but they're also the pinwheel cookies we had at Christmas time, mm-hmm. you know, and those little things that stay with you your whole life, that become such important visual elements that speak not only about your history, but about a cumulative history, you know, of other people too. Even though they don't scream pinwheel cookie, I think that people will pick that up, you know, if they had that same experience.
Mm. Yeah, that's true. And there are a lot of other elements in these paintings too that somehow remind me of something that I can't pinpoint, but I have an affection for it, mm-hmm. just the same. That piece of glass on the painting over there, mm-hmm. and those forms behind it, there's something of, you know, looking out the window at a thunderstorm or whatever. I mean, it's not even that literal, it's just some emotion that piece of glass, somehow just that piece of glass overlaid on the painting evokes something in me. I don't even know what. But
well, it's a broken piece of glass. It's a pane of glass that's come out of, you know, its wooden frame. Mm-hmm. It still has the residue of the paint on the edges, you know, so you could very well sense that it came out, you know, from a storm or something. Yeah. Something blew that window out, you know, and there it is. Yeah.
If you sit quietly and the mind gets unengaged, it tends to fill up with little fragments of thoughts and little fragments of memories and little fragments of input from what's going on around you. And there's a lot of that in these paintings too. Mm-hmm. I see, it's almost like what you see when you close your eyes.
Well, and I think that, and I think most artists do this, it's not one thing.
Right.
I mean, it's a multiple meanings are in every little element. Mm-hmm. And I've often said that I go to my art to sink my stones. You know, that's where I put my thoughts and my troubles and things like that, and they're sort of buried in there. Not literally, you know, but, you know, when I'm working on something, you know, maybe I'm having a fight with somebody. You know, these things manifest mm-hmm. themselves to me, maybe not to anybody else, but that helps build the layers, you know, the levels mm-hmm. of not only the surfaces, but the meanings, too.
It's interesting. I see in this something very akin to what I do with my sound compositions, which is I'm trying to explore the areas of sound that are not speech and that are not music and that are not what I call referential sound, the sound of a car horn or a dog barking or something. That's not speech or music, but it's almost like a vocabulary. And then there's the other sound, the stuff that we don't pay attention to that's always there, and the components of sound that create our sense of space and location and where the body is a kind of a spatial experience that's similar to the experience that we build by subliminally picking up on the acoustics of the room that we're in or the room that we're not in. And so I'm working with sound that is trying not to be definitive, is trying not to be referential or musical or rhythmic or speech. And in your work, I see a lot of that. There are things that are beginning, but they're not going to finish emerging. They're going to stay half submerged in something. And in a sense, for me, what's exciting about looking at these is coming in contact with the something rather than the things that are emerging from it. They bespeak something else that isn't really tangible. And I find that very exciting.
Well, I remember an essay that William H. Gass wrote, and he was talking about, as a child, you ride your bike past a picket fence, and you only see that much of the world at a time, he said, and so we can never experience everything. But those little bits that we see as we pass that picket fence are enough to give us some sort of glimpse as to what's going on the other side. You know, it's and that always interested me because, like you say, I don't have to give you the whole thing. You don't need the whole thing.
Right.
You know, I mean, there's enough. You know, it's it's what we leave out, actually, that makes
exactly.
the thing more
it's
interesting.
The space between the notes.
Yeah. Well, and that's a respect for the viewer as well, you know, the viewers may not even realize that they love mystery, but that's what draws people to art galleries countless times. You know, there's so many people. It's always fascinating to me when I go to a major art gallery and see these like lines of people who are willing to wait for sometimes hours to get into this museum. All sorts of people, some of whom have no art background whatsoever, and yet they enter these places like they would a cathedral and stand in front of these of works they don't understand even, but they feel something from that. And I think you, in this work, have really given the viewers that kind of respect for their strange attraction to mystery.
Well, and to bring what they know to it.
Right.
I cannot remember her name right offhand, but she said that when you read poetry, you have to leave yourself behind. And I think, no. Whenever you approach art, you bring it all with you. You have to bring yourself to it. You have to bring everything you know to it, because that's what makes the work of art, is your engagement with it, and not just what the author intends. And when I leave out, I think that, like you say, respecting the audience, I don't want to dumb them down. I don't want to give them the answers, you know, because I don't know them. And besides, it's more fun, you know, to leave the story without the ending.
And then it's fun, isn't it, to hear how each person is filling it out with their story.
And they're all right. None
all
of them are
different
wrong.
Too,
yeah, yeah.
So there's you, and there's a communion that takes place.
You were saying, Alan, before about having little microphones in the little box works. It would be fascinating to hear the comments, you know, if you have those little boxes, had a little microphone behind each one, and to hear, it would sort of be intruding on the privacy of the people who were viewing it, but it would be a fascinating thing
but
to find
that
out.
That sounds more like a piece for Alan. I mean, I could see you doing a show here with little microphones combined with the sound and the...
And little buttons that say, do not push.
I'm also curious about your working process. Do you work on a few pieces simultaneously? Do you do a work from start to finish? Do you work every day? What's your...
All of the above and none of the above. I guess when I work very intensively. And I need 12-hour stretches, you know, when I work. When I do my best work. If I don't have that, I will do something else. I will go do my gardening, I will remodel the house, I'll do something else. If I can't have that large period of time to work, and I mean daily, when I did these large pieces, that's what I did. I worked every single day at least 12 hours a day, very intense, because that's what it takes. I can do smaller things when I don't have that, but I know that it's not a cohesive unit or body of work at the end. But I do work at many things all at the same time. And sometimes I'll be working on something and discover a solution that will apply to something else. Mm-hmm. And so I can solve problems, you know, with many things all going at the same time. The trammels, there's one little trammel in there that I call home. It's a bound-up covering from an ironing board cover. Well, that little piece solved the problem for this one here, Shroud and Shadow, where I attached the piece of cloth and bound it on there. And so all the work feeds, you know, back and forth to one another. And for me, that's the best way to work. And, you know, unfortunately, life, you know, happens too. And that usually gets in the way. But I think about what... and I'm going to not say this right, but Chet Mahaly talked about, when he talks about flow, is that you have this state of being where you are only conscious of the thing in front of you that's evolving, and all of a sudden everything starts, just flows in, and it's almost like you are out of control. And everything you've ever known, everything you've ever learned, all of a sudden is flowing through your fingertips and emerging on the surface. And of course, that's the optimal experience that we all want all the time. We don't always get that because life does interrupt us. But that's what I try to recreate when I try to get those 12-hour stretches, is just that total immersion. Mm-hmm. But then, after I completed this body of work, I didn't work for a long time. And I just exhaust myself and have to sort of, you know, do something else, like lay a floor or something that's equally as inventive, you know, but not art, you know, just so.
Do you have any art projects going on right now?
I'm doing some framing right now. I have works that they're collage work made out of law book pages. That I'm going to be showing at Campbell Steel Gallery in Marion in April. But that's what I'm working on now. I'm working on another side project using very, very spare collage on masonite and lots of layers of shellac. But this is problematic. I don't know how to present them, and I just keep making them, and they go in a box. So someday I'll figure that out.
Yeah. I look forward to seeing them.
Yeah.
So that brings to mind another conversation that you and I had. you talked about the whole thing being free flowing in the studio, and when you're on and it's moving, mm-hmm. and you're getting bliss and joy and fulfillment. But when you have to then figure out how to package that for the... I have the problem, a riddle I haven't solved either, but we were resonating in this. And neither of us solved it, I don't think. But you were talking about how when it went into packaging it for the art world, or dealing with the art world, or dealing with the commercial side of the art world, the whole thing went flat for you. Mm-hmm. You want to just say a word or two about that?
Well, you know, the experience of working in the studio is it for me. I mean, that's really what I do. You know, I was talking to a weaver friend, and I told her that I would help her warp her loom, because I know how to do that. I said, but you will never get me sitting behind there weaving. I said, because once you know where that's going, it's over for me. I said, that's the beauty about working, you know, the way that I work, is that I don't know how this is going to end up, you know, and that's what keeps me going, you know, that just keep discovering, keep working and working. And once I complete the work, I'm on to the next work. But if I have to think about, okay, now, how am I going to get this, you know, with the edges sealed up, you know, do I need to put plexiglass over this, do I have to photograph this, okay, and then do I have to take it into Photoshop and correct the color and, you know, get those things sent out, and it's, that just kills it, you know, and if I can keep going long enough before I have to start subjecting myself to that, I'm okay, but once that gets in the way, that kills any sense of spirit that's left.
Do you have to force yourself to do it anyway, or can you get somebody else to do those things?
Well, you know, I don't make much of a living doing this, so I end up doing most of it myself. That which I do, I guess one of the things that I do think that I have come to terms with is that I really don't pursue the commercial gallery thing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not constantly having to deliver work, you know, new work for a gallery. I just sort of make it, and mm-hmm. if it's going to go somewhere, it's going to go somewhere, and if not, it's not.
That's why your work has power.
Well, I think because I'm true to it.
Yeah.
And I'm not pandering to any audience. I'm not pandering to any anything other than to myself. Mm-hmm. And so, and that's important. A lot of people don't have that luxury. But for me, I don't know that I would do it if I couldn't do it this way. I'd do something else. Mm-hmm. You know, and I love to do all sorts of things. You know, I'd become a cook or something, you know.
But I think it has value because of the truthfulness in it. And I think that our goal, we're not always accomplishing it because we have to deal with the realities of the presentation of artworks today. But I think in ICON we're trying to create a venue that makes it more direct from the studio with less packaging, less putting it like in a mausoleum and killing it. Mm-hmm. But I think that's our desire. Mm-hmm. We'll think more about it if we can have more direct and interactive kind of situations. Like, I love the idea of doing something here with your work where people can actually touch it and it doesn't have to go into any kind of contained, protected situation. We'll have to talk more about that. Mm-hmm.
Just to let everybody know, we've been talking with Mary Snyder Behrens from Waterloo or
Dysart.
Dysart, Iowa. And this has been wonderful. This is our second interview with Mary, and her show is currently on exhibit in ICON Gallery until April 18th. Is that right? So be sure to make
it. And Mary will be giving a gallery tour with Suanna Breed is also showing on April 16th at 8 p.m. at ICON Gallery.
Yeah, that and those gallery walks, if you haven't ever been to one, they're so fascinating. You get to go around to each work and hear the artist talking a bit about that work. You're able to ask questions, and you just, it's a great event, so I would highly recommend it.
Thank you for having me.
Well,
it's been a pleasure. Thanks for coming.
You've been listening to ICON Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.